filled the shed. Thunder vibrated beneath my feet and he was gone. For the next few hours, I sifted through the trees like a mole, blinking and wincing in the semi-darkness. After a while, the saplings began to blur into a prickly procession, spilling through my fingers. I would check myself and go back through the discarded pile at my feet and wonder if I'd been too harsh in my judgment. The pile of rejected saplings seemed to be bigger than the successful ones, and I questioned if my criteria was too harsh. Then pragmatism would win over, and I'd tell myself I needed to be ruthless, that this pile had to be shifted, and it never would be by prevaricating or becoming sentimental. Of course, my father had not given me much to go on to make my choices. He was usually vague and generalised in his instructions, but incredibly specific when it came time to inspect my work. But today was different. Perhaps because he was so preoccupied with the challenges the weather had created for him and his workers, he had doled out fewer instructions than usual about how I was to proceed. For instance, he gave no indication of what ratio of plants should be kept to those that should be rejected. He gave no clues as to the criteria I should use in filtering them, aside from that shadowy fist he had thrust in my face. I was standing in a freezing, damp, dark room, surrounded by thousands of baby trees. I began to panic. I did what I could. When my hands began to get numb, I pushed them between my thighs and held my legs close together to bring some life back into them. At times, I felt I was on a roll, but then the panic would set in. I would glance down at a mound of discarded trees and realise I'd been too hasty in my judgment. They seemed too healthy, too thick, too tall. But I couldn't save them all, could I? Every moment of doubt was compounded by the knowledge that I was wasting precious time, and before long, my father would return. And of course, he did. I heard him saying goodnight to some of his men, and my heart sank. With none of them around, he would have less motivation to rein in his fury. After a while, I heard his footsteps, and the door opened slowly. He stood for a second, silhouetted, dripping and silent, as though this was how he wanted me to remember him. I stood up from the bundles of plants and tried to ease back into the shadows. My father bent down to one of the piles I'd made, and without looking up at me, asked,
"What are these?"
"Rejects," I said questioningly. He sifted through them for a moment, and then, without warning, he backhanded me across the face. I flew through the air and landed in a heap against the stone wall of the shed. I was breathless and dizzy. The wind knocked out of me. I knew I had to get away. I began to run for the door, but my father grabbed onto my collar with one hand and smashed my mouth with his other. I fell to the ground, and instinct told me to stay there. I could tell he had only started. "What the fuck do you call this?" he railed. The storm raged outside, and it was as though my father was determined to belittle nature with his own wrath. I could only whimper, "I'm sorry." I didn't know what I was sorry for. I didn't know what he wanted. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. All I knew was that a line had been crossed. My face was throbbing, and the back of my head hurt from where it had landed against the stone wall. I was on my knees before him, and he was throwing plants on me, kicking me, and screaming at me. I had apparently rejected perfectly good saplings, and at the same time retained puny ones that should have been destroyed. There was no rhyme or reason. All I could do was hope it would be over soon, but he continued to spew insult and bile and his body at me while the crash of the storm covered the sound. Suddenly, there were spikes in my eye, and I realised he had kicked me into a pile of saplings. And then I felt the dull thud of his boot against my tailbone, and my mouth was full of them too. I wanted to stay there, face down, curled into a fetal position, and let him finish me off. But the overpowering survival instinct took over, and before he could strike again, I turned round and fell to my knees before him, sobbing and beseeching, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I didn't know, you didn't tell me." I felt pathetic, but it stopped him in his tracks. "I didn't do it on purpose. I wanted to get it right, but you didn't tell me. I'm sorry. I won't do it again. I'm so sorry. Please." I was done. Nobody was coming to save me. And nobody cared. My body began to shudder and heave with such black grief that it surprised even me. The sound of the shed door banging shut opened my eyes. He was gone. After a while, I stopped crying. There were little trees stuck to my hair and in my mouth. My face was throbbing from his blows and my bum hurt from his boot. In the eaves of the attic room of the shed was a wooden hutch my father had built to house a pair of doves we had once been given years before. For some reason, I wanted to go up there. I climbed the stairs and dropped to my knees, staring plaintively into the dark recesses of the empty coop. Time passed. The storm finally subsided. The numbness in my cheek ebbed into a swelling. Darkness fell. Still, I sat in a heap in front of the empty birdcage, tears flowing. I had thought earlier I might die. Now, once again, I wanted to. Friday the 21st of May, 2010, 5 p.m. In no time at all, I was in my London flat, having a laugh with friends. I was to be based there for the first week of shooting of Who Do You Think You Are, aside from the mystery trips I would be taking elsewhere. My old friends Sue and Dom were there to greet me, and I looked forward to catching up and having a laugh about the insanity of the night before in Cannes, each anecdote more sweet in its telling because it was now just that, an anecdote and not real life. I could relate the palpable drama after the auctioneer told Jennifer Lopez her dress made her look like an ostrich, but not have to see it or feel it. There would be no anxiety that the name of the celebrity I was about to announce would not be the same as the one who walked on stage. There would be no celebrities at all, in fact. Just me and my besties. Sue and I had met many years ago at the Donmar Warehouse Theatre in London. I was there playing Hamlet, immediately followed by my turn as the MC in Cabaret that later transferred to Broadway, and we had been best friends ever since. When people ask how we met, Sue likes to tell them she washed my undies. And indeed she did, for then she was a member of that most noble of professions, the theatre dresser. She was also, and is, totally gorgeous. Quite literally, actually. Her surname had originally been Gore, but she changed it legally to Gorgeous after years of it being her unofficial moniker. The actual document she had to sign to complete the name-changing process was hilarious, asking her to solemnly swear to renounce the name Gore and to be, from that day forth, forever gorgeous. And she has been. When she married Dom, I and our other bestie, Andrew, were male bridesmaids, stifling our giggles as Sue walked down the aisle to Elvis, singing It's Now or Never. As the wine flowed and the laughter rose, I felt the feeling I most enjoyed. Home. Then, Sue's phone rang. Hi, Tom, she said. Oh, he's here. He arrived about an hour ago. I wonder why my big brother would call Sue and not me to find out my whereabouts. Sue passed me her phone, and immediately I knew something was wrong. How are you doing? Tom asked, a little shaky. Obviously he hadn't intended to speak to me. I'm good, how are you? I replied cautiously. When am I going to see you then? Tomorrow night, remember, we're all having dinner, I said, referring to the plan for him, his wife Sonia, a bunch of my London friends, and me to meet up in my favourite Chinese restaurant the next evening. I really need to talk to you, Alan. There was silence for a moment. I tried to process what this meant. Well, why don't you come up a bit early tomorrow and have a drink with me at the flat before dinner? I said eventually. No, I need to talk to you sooner than that. Tom was trying to hold it together, but the cracks were beginning to show. Tom, what's wrong? I can't tell you on the phone, Alan. Is it your health? My mind immediately raced to the worst possible scenarios. My brother is a rock. If he acted like this, it meant there was really something badly wrong. Something happened between you and Sonia? No, no. I could hear Tom, even in the midst of whatever painful thing he was dealing with, trying to reassure me. It was what he had always done for me. Is something wrong with Mum? But I'd spoken to Mary Darling several times that week, and had listened to a message from her just that day. There was no way she could have hidden anything bad from me. Suddenly, I remembered what Mary Darling had said about the reporter. Is it something to do with that Sunday Mail guy looking for Dad? It's all come to a head, Alan, was Tom's response. I need to talk to you tonight. It took Tom 3 hours to get to me. He lives in Southampton and had to catch a train, and what with travel to and from the stations, I had to endure 3 whole hours of my mind racing and my heart thumping. Sue and Dom tried to distract me, but I could never wander far from the worry. What could possibly be making my brother so upset that he couldn't even utter it to me on the phone? I was a mess. My mind went to very dark places. The press being involved was a particularly disturbing element. If I'd had the ability at that moment to be rational, I would have realised that there was nothing particularly scandalous about my life that had not been revealed or touched on before now, and I might have taken solace from this added boon of having become an open book. But I was finding it hard to see solace anywhere. I started to get wheezy. I have asthma, and one of the times it comes on is during moments of great stress. Sue is luckily a self-confessed hypochondriac and an expert on all homeopathic remedies, so before too long I had a mouthful of pills to distract me. But still the nagging anxiety persisted, and still Tom hadn't arrived. He kept texting, "I'm on the train, I'm nearly at Waterloo, I'm getting in a taxi." I kept replaying our phone conversation. Had my father died? Was it something to do with my husband, Grant? He was heading home to New York City now. Could something have happened to him? But still at the root of it all was the reporter from the Sunday Mail and the fact that, as Tom had said, it had all come to a head. But what did that mean? By the time he arrived, I felt I'd aged 10 years. He entered the flat, looking remarkably normal. No tears, no visible signs of torment. If anything, he looked a little sheepish, as if he were embarrassed by all the fuss he must have known he'd caused by losing it on the phone. For a moment my heart leapt and I thought that maybe this revelation, whatever it might be, was not going to be as portentous and damaging as I'd feared. There were a few awkward moments of small talk, and then he looked at me. "Shall we go upstairs?" Then. When I was little, I was bullied by an older boy named David on the school bus. David's dad was the head carpenter on the estate where ours was the head forester. Tom, 6 years older than me and a year older than David, had graduated to high school by then, and we went our separate ways each morning. Tom went to Carnoustie and the swanky new high school, while I went to Manicky and the tiny Victorian stone grade school where there were only 6 people in my class. The bus I rode looked like something left over from the Second World War, and indeed, it was. It was a big, hulking, dark blue military transport type of thing, with 2 long benches that faced one another across a vast stretch of floor. The thing about that layout, of course, was that you could never look away from anyone. Everyone saw everyone else and everything that went on all the time. Every afternoon on the way home, and some mornings, I was kicked and pushed and slapped off the seat, my ears twisted back and forth, my books flung around and trodden on, the straps of my school bag held so I couldn't get away, and all the while, through my cries of pain and fear, his taunts that I had no big brother now to protect me were ringing in my red and sore ears. Luckily, the journey back to the estate gates was a short one, and as soon as the bus stopped, I leapt off and made a terrified bolt down the drive, much to the amusement of my tormentor and his little brothers. It was all very Lord of the Flies, and I was Piggy. David was a nice enough boy, and I realised now that his bullying of me that summer was just his way of establishing the new world order of the Manicky school bus. My brother had been the undisputed leader till he had ascended to high school, and so by terrorising me, David was not only defining himself as alpha male, but also as the new Tom Cumming. How better to show that your former leader's power is naught than by making his little brother cry? But then I was mad as hell and I was not going to take it anymore. I told Tom. Nothing much was said, just a tearful confession after he asked me if everything was going okay at school without him. I almost forgot about it until one night we were cycling home from Cub Scouts. David and his siblings were in a gaggle ahead of us. Tom shouted out to David to wait up and then told me to carry on home. "What are you going to do?" I asked, suddenly alarmed. "Just go home, Alan. I'll be there in a wee while." I did as I was told, pedalling fast and whizzing through the estate gates and down the driveway, through the sawmill yard to our house and into the bike shed. My heart was racing, my mind a whirl of what awful torture or bloodshed might be taking place at that very moment on my behalf. My parents didn't seem to pick up on my nervousness. My mum looked up from her ironing and asked where Tom was when I entered the living room, and my dad kept his gaze on the TV. Minutes later, Tom arrived, cool as a cucumber, and gave me a stony look that I knew meant we must never speak of this again. 5 minutes later, the doorbell rang, and I raced out to answer it, my heart now in my mouth. I opened the door to find David, weeping and clutching his already bruising eye, being held up by his irate mum. "Get your father!" David's mum yelled, My father ushered them in. Suddenly, out of nowhere, our living room was a courtroom and I was both the smoking gun and the cause of the crime. "Your son gave my son a black eye," David's mum shouted. "Well, Tommy, is this true?" our father yelled, even though I could tell he was secretly proud. "Yes, it is," Tom said, pulling himself up and embracing his sins. "But David's been bullying Alan on the school bus for months now." Everything stopped. David's teenage shame was now exposed for everyone to see. I felt so sorry for him. This skinny adolescent who had shoved me off my seat and thrown my books around and held me down and whacked me countless times. He had never made me feel as mortified as I knew he now felt. Suddenly, I was shaken from my sympathetic reverie by the realization that the adults had stopped shouting. David had stopped crying. In fact, the whole room had stopped and was now looking at me, waiting for me to bring the whole sorry mess to some sort of conclusion. "Well, Alan," my dad said, "is this true?" The room fell quiet. I could feel my cheeks burning and everyone's eyes boring deep, laser-like, into mine.
"No,"
I said meekly. Much as I wanted to defend Tom's tribal quid pro quo, I also felt so sorry for David, snivelling away, the bruise around his eye colouring darker by the second. It was just too much to deal with, and I chose what I thought was the lesser of two evils. As soon as I denied he was my tormentor, I'd burst into tears, and the adults mercifully realised they were putting a 9-year-old under too much duress, especially when there came no protestation of innocence from David. The clerks went home. I was comforted, and the matter was never mentioned again. In some way, there was an agreement between us all that justice had been served. An eye for an eye, or more like a black eye for a series of bruises and stingy ears. I told this story at my brother's wedding. His third, incidentally. We Cumming boys love a wedding. For me, it is emblematic of our relationship. Tom always the protective big brother. Me in awe of the enormity of his devotion and screwing things up. Friday the 21st of May, 2010, 8 p.m. Almost 40 years later, Tom is sitting across the table from me on the roof deck of my flat, visibly shaking and seemingly incapable of beginning the speech that he knows is going to blow my world apart. He stammers and makes several false starts. I beg him to just say it, to just tell me. I'm going mad with the waiting. At first, he apologises because he has already told Grant. Again, I can't process what that means. He says he didn't know how best to tell me, and so he called Grant for advice. Everything was whirring. My thoughts, Tom's voice, the skyline of Soho all around us. He finally manages to get out that our father had called him 10 days ago. "What did he say?" I whispered. I was shaking. I'd started to cry. I was in hell. "Please, Tom, please." Tom looked up at me, his blue eyes filled with tears too. He gulped, and finally he said it. "He told me to tell you that you're not his son." I learned something about myself that night, something I had no idea about. And about a month later, one sweaty afternoon on a terrace in southern Malaysia, I was reminded of it again. When I get really shocking news, my entire body tries to get the hell away as quickly as possible. Before I'd really processed what Tom had said, I found myself propelling backwards, knocking over the bench I was sitting on and careening away from my brother. It felt as though I needed to push this incredible information back, giving myself the space necessary to even contemplating it. Downstairs, Sue and Dom thought the sound they were hearing was Tom and me fighting and that a body had just been flung to the floor. "What do you mean?" I kept asking. Tom was holding me now, trying to calm me down. This information was so far from left field, it was not even in the field. To say it was the last thing I expected to hear was an understatement of an understatement. "You're not his son," he said again. Tom was crying too now, but he could see how overwhelmed I was, how much I needed more information and fast. "He called me a week ago, weeping," he began. "Dad called you? Dad called you weeping?" I spluttered. Nothing was making sense. "Yes. He said he was never going to tell you and was just going to leave you a letter in his will. But he knew you were doing the television show and so he wanted to tell you to stop you being embarrassed in public by finding out that way," he went on. Tom was rubbing tears away with his thumb. I suddenly felt so sorry for him. He was still the big brother, my protector, and here we were once again, weeping and scared and clinging to each other. I thought our father had no power over us anymore. I was wrong. Find out what, Tom? Please try and tell me quickly. I'm scared. My heart is beating so fast. I think I'm going to have a heart attack. Indeed, my heart was pounding so hard, I felt the need to clutch both hands to my chest just to make sure it stayed inside my body. You're in shock, Tom said. Take deep breaths. He continued. He called me again this Thursday and apologised for being so hysterical on the phone the first time. He said he's on a lot of painkillers for his cancer and he thinks he must have overdone it, but he wanted to assure me, well, to assure you, that it was all true, and he was going to leave you a letter telling you everything in his will, but he wants you to know now, and he says if you ask Mum, she'll deny it, but he's willing to take a DNA test. Who is my father then? I sobbed. Who is he? Tom said a name. It was not someone I knew, but a name I remembered as a family friend from long ago. From, in fact, the time and the place we lived when I was born. Just hearing that name made everything a bit less abstract. Its familiarity grounded me, and I began to calm down. My breathing became more regulated, my pulse slowed. This was real. It wasn't just a joke to hurt or scare me, like so many of my father's edicts from the past. It was real. What else did he say? He said that he and Mum were at a dance at the Burnham Hotel in Dunkeld. Mum was gone for a while, and this guy's wife said he was gone too, and Dad and the wife both started looking for them. They went all over the bar and the dance floor, and then they went through into the hotel and they saw them, Mum and the guy, coming out of a bedroom together. And then what? And then 9 months later you were born, he added, like he was telling me a really fucked up bedtime story. I couldn't quite believe that my father wasn't doing this just to hurt me. One last hurrah, if you will, before he died. And the timing of it. How could he possibly think that Who Do You Think You Are would focus on something so sensational and upsetting and undocumented? And then I remembered my father's experience of dealing with the media and it made total sense. Was he actually trying to protect me for once? Of course, I also reasoned he would also be protecting himself. His cuckolding going public would dent the ego of a man like him immeasurably. I was not my father's son. It wasn't supposed to have happened like this at all. Tom had discussed it with Grant, and they both felt that I should be told when I was home in New York with Grant by my side. Tom planned to fly over in a couple of weeks once I'd returned from filming in South Africa and tell me in as calm and protected an environment as possible. Poor Grant, therefore, had known this secret for the last few days we were in Cannes, keeping it to himself and never suspecting that events would dictate that Tom would need to tell me so soon. What had happened was that the reporter from the Sunday Mail had found my father. Once again, the tabloid press had managed to cause havoc in our family. Earlier that day, Tom had been driving home when my father called him, fuming and ranting about a reporter outside his front door. It's difficult to express the intensity of my father's rage. I'm sure that even as a dying man, it would be terrifying. Suddenly, Tom saw a police car parked on the side of the road and so took the phone away from his ear for a moment. When he picked it up again, our father was still railing, so Tom assured him he would deal with the matter and hung up. He panicked that our father's suspicions were correct and that the imminent shoot of my Who Do You Think You Are had indeed prompted the news of my true lineage to somehow be leaked, and the idea that I might find out the news by seeing it splashed across the front page of a newspaper horrified him. He decided he had to tell me that night and called Sue to find out what time I was arriving. After he'd spoken to me, he finished his journey home and then called our father back to tell him he'd set the wheels in motion and was on his way to tell me everything before I found out via the press. Of course, this is when our father had told him that the reporter hadn't mentioned anything about who my real father was, but had in fact merely wanted a comment about that Times article. Our father's fury was actually directed at me for having mentioned he had cancer, not that this massive secret had been exposed. Tom was distraught, but now it was too late, and he had no choice but to follow through. "What about Mum?" I asked. "Did you talk to her about it?" "Not yet," said Tom. "I wanted to let her know I was going to tell you, but I didn't get a chance." "Don't," I blurted. "Don't talk to her until this is all sorted out in my head." Our family had always been one of secrets, of silence, of holding things in. The fact that my mother had never told me this, even in the decades since she and my father had divorced, was, perhaps surprisingly, not a surprise to me. She must have had her reasons, I thought, and whatever they were, I respected them, right now at least. It was incredible to think of my mother being the one who had strayed, when it was my father's infidelity that had so upset me as a child. Perhaps my mum's silence was even to protect my father, something we all seemed unremittingly conditioned to do. She was the most loyal person I knew, and if they had made a pact to stay silent all those years ago, it was no surprise that finally the one to break it would be him. Although I was shell-shocked by the news, I was also so glad my mother had someone else in her life, some love, someone who hopefully treated her with kindness and tenderness. If I was the product of that, it couldn't be such a bad thing, I decided. Tom told me more of what our father had said in the phone call, how he had suspected my mother of having an affair with this man, and how, when he had seen them come out of the hotel room that night all those years ago, he merely said, "Well, there's no point in staying here any longer," grabbed her by the arm and marched her home. It was never spoken of again. "Well, there's no point in staying here any longer." That was exactly the kind of thing I would expect my father to say in that situation. Something gruff, uncaring. Though I'd never imagined the idea of my father being in a situation where he would be the one discovering his spouse's infidelity. You see, my father was a big philanderer. His disregard for his wife's feelings, and indeed anyone who knew him, by the audaciousness of how openly and often he paraded his infidelity, was almost autistic in its terrible repetition, and it still manages to shock me. Everyone knew. Even when I was at primary school, I was aware that he was having affairs. I can't remember exactly how I came to know, but I do remember the first time I recognised the pain that knowing gave me. I was 8 years old, sitting on the grass of the playing field at Manicki Primary during lunch break. A little girl from my class was threading a daisy chain nearby. "Why are you sad, Alan?" she asked me out of the blue. I hesitated, slightly shocked that my sadness was palpable. I realised I needed to learn how to hide my feelings better, even outside the home. My training in the ways of the actor came early, you see. I wasn't sure how to articulate it. "Today is my mum and dad's wedding anniversary and they're not celebrating it," I said finally, a dry lump in my throat. It was true, but it wasn't the whole story, of course. Somehow I understood that the whole truth was shameful and must not be spoken of. I understood that I had to collude to protect my father, even though he didn't deserve it. My father continued to have affairs throughout my childhood, and they were not subtle or discreet. He had no shame about parading his conquests in public. Sometimes even at the rare events, our whole family, albeit separately, would attend. I remember a barn dance at a farm down the hill and watching my mother's face as my father arrived with another woman in tow. At school, I would hear little comments and jokes about his affairs. One of them was actually a teacher of mine. Now, decades later, it was all beginning to make sense. Was his brazen disregard for my mother's and anyone else's feelings about his affairs due to the fact that he felt justified because my mother had committed the original sin? And was this the reason for her stoic acceptance of his behaviour too? It certainly explained the way he treated me. Hundreds of flashbacks of acts of violence and humiliation were being replayed in my mind. Now I saw them through a filter of knowing that my very existence was a reminder to my father of betrayal, even of his failure. But as Tom pointed out, our father was an equal opportunity abuser, and I was not alone in my place as his target. Our father was just as harsh, irrational, and violent to Tom. I felt a bit calmer, even though there were still mental fireworks going off inside my head. I needed to make a plan. I knew that the shockwaves of this news would not be confined to this evening. The repercussions of this bombshell would reverberate in my life for a long time to come. "And there's another thing," Tom said. I looked up at him with dread. "Dad's considering talking to the male." "What?" I couldn't believe this could get any more awful. "Not about you not being his son," Tom clarified. "Well, what then?" "He's angry that they know about him having cancer, and they're telling him he should have his say about you before he dies. Tom's voice trailed off. Oh, perfect. Well, good luck to him, I said. If he wants to go down that road, that's his decision, but he'll regret it for the rest of his life. He has no idea what shit they'll make up. I couldn't believe it. Any of it. But at least, I was not my father's son. I felt like someone had died. And I suppose in a way someone had. My father was dead. Or at least the father I assumed to be mine, both literally and physically. I felt like I had created a narrative about my father over the last 45 years, and now I was mourning its death. I needed to give myself some time. I needed to recover. I knew I would have to eventually speak to both my parents, but I couldn't fathom that yet. The idea of contacting my new father was too daunting to even think about. I also wanted to get off the roof. It was getting dark now and cold. I was shivering, whether from the cold or pure shock, I didn't know. I knew that Sue and Dom would be worried sick. I wanted to put them out of their misery. Tom and I had been up there for ages, and I wanted to actually speak the words to another human being to make them real. We went down and told Sue and Dom, and spent the rest of the night talking and drinking and marvelling at the insanity that can descend in an instant. Mostly we talked about memories from our childhood, horrible moments we had shared, somehow trying to tie them to what we now knew, reassessing and realigning. Tom stayed over that night. We both bunked down in the sleeping loft at the very top of the flat. We were spent, dazed, cried and talked out. We said goodnight and I switched the light off, but after a while, I could feel him still awake across from me. "You know, Alan, you're lucky," he whispered. "You're lucky you're not his son." "I know," I said. Then, for a few days every June in Arbroath, a town about 10 miles from our house, something magical called the Angus Show happened. It was a traditional agricultural show, with sheep shearing and dog trials and Highland cows and tractors and tugs of war, but also vans full of household wares and trinkets being flogged by men who lured you to spend by shouting ever-decreasing prices through their tinny microphones. There were stalls selling all sorts of food that seemed, to a country boy like me, incredibly exotic. Things like corn on the cob and donuts. But the thing I liked most of all about the Angus Show was the humanity. The seething crowds of people that flooded the Victoria Park. I loved the feeling of being part of a crowd, of being one amongst many. It made me feel safe. Every year as June drew near, I'd see the posters for the show appearing on trees and telegraph poles all over the county. They were colourful and full of promise, and I yearned to be able to go. That was the thing, though. I never knew if I would be permitted to go. It would mean getting a lift from my dad, and as it was so difficult to predict his mood and his willingness to keep his promises, I came to never rely on him at all, and eventually just stopped asking him for a lift anywhere. Occasionally a friend's parent would offer to pick me up, but we lived in such a remote place I rarely engineered it. Plus, I knew my father would see such an arrangement as a betrayal or an act of cowardice on my part. If I did, I would make sure to be dropped at the estate gates and not risk the friends coming anywhere near our house. This was a form of protection for my family, but as I got older it was more about protecting my self-esteem than shielding my father's potential behaviour. The older I became, the less concerned I became about people knowing what a monster he was. I was waiting for the day I could leave home and escape him. And anyway, my brother and I biked mostly everywhere. Even as little boys, we would cycle for miles up and down the hills and lanes of Angus. I seriously think the reason I have strong legs today is because my formative years were spent in daily, intense exercise of them. We biked to the Cubs and Scouts meetings, to badminton at Manikey Hall, several miles there and back. And then later, when we were older, we'd bike all the way to Carnoustie, at least a 10-mile round trip, starting the journey by free-wheeling down the enormous hill called the Marches, just south of the estate gates, exhilarated by the rush of the wind as we sped and the rush to be free of our father's rule for a few hours. Cycling back up at the end of the night was not quite so exhilarating. But hey, as I say, we both have calves to die for. This particular summer, I was 13. As usual, I was working my entire summer break on the estate, brashing. Brashing involved taking a saw that was attached to a long pole and cutting away all the branches of a spruce tree as far up as you could reach and all the way down to the ground, thereby allowing the tree to send its energy up to the higher branches and grow taller faster, and also giving future foresters easier access when they came to cut it down and sent it off to the sawmill. Each morning at the crack of dawn, I set off with a few older boys, our saws balanced precariously across the handlebars of our bikes, our packed lunches in bags slung round our shoulders. We would spend the day in some remote part of the estate, brashing away, regularly abandoning our work to race off in every direction to avoid the attacks by wasps whose nests we'd disturbed. My father would come and inspect our work at least once a day. We would hear his van approaching and immediately we would double our efforts. Nobody wanted to get on the wrong side of him, least of all me. Often one of us would be called back down our row to inspect a substandard job on a tree. The walk of shame across the forest floor strewn with newly hacked branches was something I dreaded. He wouldn't hit the other boys, just humiliate them. I did my best to give him no reason to hit me in front of them, but sometimes it happened, and I would have to endure the awkward silence as I returned to my saw, trying not to cry, trying to will the sting in my ear or my face to go away. One night, I slumped into a chair in the living room, exhausted from my day in the forest, my hands blistered from the chafing of the saw shaft. We had no sofa, I realised now, only individual chairs. You'd think that would make the living room feel lonely and isolating, but actually I remember it as feeling safer because you could sit alone. That night my father did something very surprising. "Do you want to go to the Angus show this Saturday then?" I don't think his eyes left the TV screen. A programme called Crossroads was on. Of course, I knew he wasn't the least bit interested in a soap opera about a motel in the Midlands, yet he would rather look at it than me, even during this rare act of kindness. "Yes," I said in the neutral, flat way I'd learned was best when asked a question by him. This was manlier and offered less chance of being disappointed by showing emotion. "Fine. We'll leave here at 12:30 on Saturday." My mother was through in the kitchen doing the dishes and I knew she would have heard this exchange. Later, when my father was upstairs changing for his night out, she came through and sat down in the chair opposite me. "Your father's going to take you to the Angus show," she said, picking up her knitting. "Yes," I replied, avoiding her eyes. "But I don't have to go." I felt torn. I really wanted to go, but I also wanted to show my mother that my loyalty lay with her, for we both knew what my going with my father would entail. In the past, the only times my father had ever taken me anywhere of his own volition were bittersweet experiences. For even though I enjoyed these rare glimpses into a life that might have been, a seemingly loving dad taking his son swimming or out to a cafe for a strawberry tart and a glass of pop, I knew that in so doing, he had made me an unwilling accomplice in his affair of the moment. The time at the pool years before had been traumatizing. She was waiting for us at the entrance. Neither my father nor she made any attempt to explain her appearance, and I knew better than to question it. It was a woman I knew. I even knew her husband. As I splashed around on my own in the shallow end, I could glimpse them farther up, smiling and nuzzling, she with her back against the pool wall, my father facing her, his arms outstretched, gripping the ledge on either side of her, right under a sign with a big "no" at the top, followed by a list of the sorts of behaviour not tolerated in this establishment, including, to my horror, heavy petting, exactly what my father and this woman were engaging in right at that very moment. Even then, as a young boy, I was amazed at my father's brazenness. There would surely have been people they knew in this pool who would have seen them. They seemed to have absolutely no care that they might be compromising or embarrassing those people with their actions. I realised that my father had total disregard for anyone's feelings, let alone his wife's, or indeed his small son's, who at this very moment felt he was being dragged down into a cesspool of deceit and crime just by being near them. Afterwards, My father informed me that the woman would be joining us for a cup of tea and that I could have a strawberry tart, a seasonal delicacy so delicious and so rarely experienced that my brother and I would speak of them in hushed tones. Even as I savoured it, I knew I was being bought. But why did my father take me on these meetings? I've often wondered. He must have known my mum would ask me and I would tell her that we had not been alone. And while my mother seemed to tolerate my father's pandemic infidelity, she drew the line at our children being accessories. A huge row between them ensued as soon as we got home that day. I was obviously being used by my father in some way, but how? Was I brought along to remind this woman that despite their obvious and public entanglement, he was still a family man with responsibilities and that their affair would always have to remain just that? Or worse, was I there as a sort of decoy to somehow show a softer, kinder side of my father, to balance the more brutish front he presented to the world? Maybe he felt my being there made him and the woman seem more like a family and therefore less illicit to others around us. Back home, giddy with both the rare attentions of my father and the sugar high of the soda and the strawberry tart, I came crashing down to earth when I saw my mother so angry. Soon after that, my Saturday mornings were no longer my own, as I was put to work on the estate, peeling posts in the sawmill or weeding the seedbeds in the nursery. It was back-breaking work, but I was glad to avoid such compromising situations. Even strawberry tarts had lost their luster. Now, several years later, I could sense a mile off that my father's willingness to take me to the Angus show had conditions. My mother looked up from her knitting and smiled kindly at me. "No, you go to the show, Pet. I know how much you want to." Saturday came, and at the appointed hour we set off in silence. I had my wages from the brashing burning a hole in my pocket. I hoped my father would let me have some time of my own to go and spend it. We had to park far away from the showground, but I loved the walk, the sounds and smells wafting ever nearer us as we approached. My father walked with determination to the agricultural machinery section. There were stands with tractors and combine harvesters, and you could climb into their cabs and pretend to drive them. I didn't, of course. I was too old for that now. But I had done so as a little boy, and seeing other kids do it now made me happy and nostalgic for that time. Then, standing nonchalantly by a stall where you could collect leaflets and keychains with the tractor company logos on them, I saw her. It was not the woman I expected, yet she was not a stranger to me. We said our polite hellos, and they pretended it was a total coincidence we had bumped into each other in this seething mass. Then my father strode off, and she followed. I knew better than to linger and dutifully scampered after them. Thus began a weird dance. She and my father would be ahead of me, and suddenly they were gone. Fearing the wrath that would ensue if I became lost, I began to panic and scanned the area, leaping up and down to see over the heads for a sight of them. I wove my way through the crowds to rejoin them, marvelling at how quickly we had become separated and vowing to myself to be extra diligent from then on. Stalls that would normally have caught my eye, I ignored. At one point we stopped at an army recruitment trailer, and as I glanced at the photos of burly men driving helicopters and tanks, I waited for my father to start in on a story about his days in the forces. His national service in the Royal Air Force was a source of great pride for him, even though, as I grew older and began to ask more questions, I realised he'd only worked in his barracks kitchens and had never seen any actual combat. Still, the order, the discipline, the unquestioning acquiescence to rule had obviously made a great impression on him. Of course, it also crossed my mind that Tom and I were now his soldiers. But the usual story of some fellow's squaddy's ineptness never came that day. I looked up, and my father was gone. She was gone. They had both disappeared into the crowds, and I knew in an instant that they had intended to do so. That they had, in fact, been trying to lose me for the last quarter of an hour. I had doggedly pursued them, fearful of my father's wrath, little knowing that he was trying to engineer their flight all along. My father had purposely abandoned me. My instincts were that I should try to find them, but knowing that they had purposely tried to lose me quieted the panic that was rising from my stomach. I told myself that I had done everything I could. Surely my father would not have the audacity to punish me for this. I also started to make a plan. I looked at my options. It was light. There were many people around, and I had money. but I knew that telling anyone about what had happened, even the public, I've lost my dad version, would not be tolerated by him. And taking a bus to Muirdrum and then walking the remaining several miles to the estate would be too much of a transgression also, so that was out of the question too. My only option, and I thought for certain the option my father both wanted and knew I would take, was to stay in the park, wander around until they returned and take my chances. There was nothing else for me to do. There's a thing in Scotland called smur, and it's miserable. It comes off the sea and it's not quite a rain, but it's thicker than a mist. Well, right then, it started smurring. Being alone in that showground turned out to be one of the most exciting times of my 13-year-old life. In the midst of one of my father's terrorising, psychotic mind games, I was suddenly given freedom. I realised that whatever I did in the time it took for him and the woman to do whatever they had snuck off to do was up to me. They hadn't just accidentally lost me in the crowd. They had run off. They had abandoned me. I then remembered his van being parked so far away and wondered if the seclusion had also been part of his plan. I felt flushed with the feeling that for the first time ever, I held all the cards. But soon that glow evaporated, and I began to worry that they might not return, or worse, he would return alone and she would not be there to supply the buffer to my father's wrath that I was counting on. I felt lonely and yet liberated, euphoric and afraid. At that time, my brother Tom and his fiancée were busy creating their bottom drawer, a collection of household items for their life together that would be accrued throughout their engagement. Each time they bought or were given something to add to it filled me with panic, for it meant that the day Tom would leave me alone in our house was coming closer. And also I felt jealous, for each pot or bedspread was a sign of a future, other life, and a symbol of hope that I, as yet, could not imagine. But now, alone in a showground with people positively bursting to sell me things and with my wages just waiting to be spent, I did something that filled my heart with joy and surely held a deeper symbolic meaning. I bought myself a dinner service. I didn't mean to. I was 13 after all and not likely to be throwing any dinner parties for quite a while hence. But I needed to feel comfort. I needed to know that there was a future for me that did not involve my father and a woman who was not my mother running around like schoolchildren trying to hide from me, dashing off to the back of a van carefully parked in a quiet side street. I needed to imagine a home where I would not be tormented, where I would be in control, where I would be the one inviting others into my space, and I would be providing for them. I needed to jumpstart the process that my brother was embarking on for myself. It took me ages to gin up the courage to bid. The stallholder said he had half a dozen of the sets to sell off at this never-to-be-repeated price, but I waited till the very end of his rant, when he'd said it was his absolute lowest offer at least 10 times, and then I gingerly raised my hand. A box was almost thrown towards me. I felt people looking at me sideways, wondering why an unaccompanied child was bidding for tableware in the rain. I walked away from the crowds towards the animal section, where I sat on a bale of hay and peered into the cardboard box of treasure, of future, that I had just acquired. Beige and bland, with 70s-style flowers printed on every plate, bowl and cup, I thought they were the most sophisticated things I had ever seen. They were my ticket out. I would be eating off them in a place where there were buses and taxis, and where I would never have to wait in a public place for hours, cold and damp, wondering if my father had concluded his liaison and if or when he would come for me. He did, of course. Both of them did. It was dark and the field was nearly empty and they actually had the audacity to pretend they had genuinely lost me, but I knew they were lying. The very fact that he did not explode when he saw me was immediate and total proof. And though it doesn't give me much pleasure to say it, he wasn't a very good actor. Now, up until very recently, I still had one of the saucers from that dinner service. The rest of the set had gradually been broken or given away to charity shops during my many moves through student flats in Glasgow and marital homes there and in London. But I always hung on to that one saucer because it was a talisman of my escape to adulthood from my dark years as a child, and reminded me of the actual day when I had the first inkling that I might actually get away. Sadly, the saucer did not survive my move to America, but I can still see it in my mind. It still glows in my heart. Saturday the 22nd of May 2010. I woke up in the white attic and Tom was gone. I lay awake for some time, too exhausted to move. The day was a blur. I'd lunch with Elizabeth, the director of Who Do You Think You Are, and the only moment I acknowledged anything was wrong came at the same time as the bill. I just wanted to say that I understand there's going to be some surprises during the shoot, but can I just put it out there that... I hesitated, not quite knowing how to convey what I meant. I just needed to give myself an out somehow. I'm feeling a little delicate right now. You know, I've been travelling and I'm tired and a bit overwhelmed. If there's anything really big and completely from left field, you'll give me some sort of hint to prepare myself, won't you? Elizabeth looked me in the eye, a little taken aback. Well, of course, I can't tell you anything in advance, but I will be as respectful to you and your family's feelings as I possibly can. I thought that was really tender and comforting, and exactly what I needed to hear. Of course, the reality was a little less tender and comfortable. Saturday night was spent with my London friends, people I had known and loved long, but see less and less frequently. I was in a daze throughout dinner, but acted like the person I wanted to be in that scenario, happy, secure, open. I pulled it off, mostly. Months later, a very perceptive friend told me she had suspected that night that I was really ill. I was certainly not in my right mind. All day, my mind had been a constant rotation of memories of what had been inconsequential moments that now seemed full of portent. I mentally scanned all the childhood pictures of myself and Tom and remembered how I'd always joked about our different body types. Tom, the skinny boy athlete with his washboard stomach, and me, the rosy-cheeked little brother with his wee belly. Now it made sense. I swam that afternoon, the water the perfect place to soak up the whirring of my mind. As I was walking home, I suddenly stopped outside Foyle's bookshop just off Charing Cross Road. I was quiet for a few moments and then said aloud, "That's why I don't have a hairy chest." Now. Recently, I attended an interactive theatre piece in the Brooklyn Museum. Towards the end of the evening, I was taken into a corner by a soft-spoken Japanese lady. She sat me down, took my hands in hers, and asked me if the world were to end and I could choose one person to save. Did I know who that person would be? I told her I did. Then she asked me if I thought that in the same circumstances, the person I had chosen would choose to save me. I said I knew that they would. She looked up at me with tears in her eyes. "You are so lucky," she said. "Some people don't even know who they would save." One of the good things about having had more than a few relationships before I met Grant is that when we did meet, I knew quite a lot about myself, and so did he. We should have done, I suppose. We were both 39, after all. And so along with the euphoria and passion of our coming together was a conversation that was adult, honest, and frank. We're also conditioned to entering relationships hiding our baggage. Now he and I were laying ours out unashamedly and embracing it. It felt very good. It still does. Grant is the kindest, funniest person I've ever met, and I've known some kind, funny people. I feel so lucky to have met him because I think we should be together. We just work, and we have the same colour eyes. When I look into his, I feel I'm looking into myself. Sunday the 23rd of May, 2010. Grant woke me up on Sunday morning. He'd arrived home in New York, listened to the messages I'd left him, and got straight back on a plane. I suddenly felt buoyed. I had so many things I needed to do. With Grant coming, I felt I could finally take a step. I was more and more worried about the possibility of my father giving an interview to the Sunday Mail. I had no idea how many times reporters had come to his home over the years, but I'd seen the few printed articles he had supplied quotes for, and there was no way anyone could interpret those as positive experiences, so why was he threatening to do this now? Now, of all times, when he had just announced his lack of connection to me, or renounced his connection, more like. And then the panic began to set in. Was that what he was going to talk about? Was he going to spill the beans to the press before he'd even spoken to me? Or before I had a chance to talk to my mum? I wouldn't put it past him. But that just didn't make sense. My father would never allow the last thing the world knew of him before he died to be that he had been cuckolded. He? But he was very ill, and Tom had said he had been weeping on the phone. It was all so out of character. Tom had spoken to our dad again a couple of times in the past few days and informed him that I wanted to go ahead with a DNA test. He told me our father had begun to prevaricate and wanted to wait a few days before going ahead with any test. Why?